Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
If we want to build back better, this phrase that's framing the recovery, I think for us that means building back more equitably.
What does it really mean to build back better? Well, on today's show, we're going to rewrite the most recent of urbanist battle cries and look at how to build back equally. Because now is the moment our cities can truly think about how to build in gender, racial, spatial and economic equality as visions begin to form of what our built environment can be in a post-pandemic era. So join me and a collection of experts as we discuss the next steps for cities around the world right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Many cities have spent the past year in hibernation, but as we start to plan what's next, just like a butterfly emerging from its chrysalis, we hope that the built environment will also emerge better than what it was before. The pandemic has put at the forefront some of the inequalities that already existed in our cities. So when we think about building back better, surely our biggest consideration should be combating the imbalances and building back more equally too. So let's start today by looking at the gender inequalities highlighted by the last 12 months. Sally Neshaw is a programme expert at Urbact, who support cities working on all sorts of urban challenges as part of the European Development Fund, with the hope that the knowledge produced will go on to influence policy. Sally is also the lead on Urbact's Gender Equal Cities Network, and I'm pleased to say that she joins me on the show. Well, Sally, thank you for being here. Now, much of your work has focused on the gendered impacts that our cities can have on their citizens. Adding in now the pandemic into the conversation, how do you think that the past year is going to impact the lives of women and girls in our cities as we try and build back in a better way?
The Urbact programme started to work on gender equality a couple of years ago because we saw that in spite of the progress that's been made in the past decades, that inequality is persistent. As cities are the level of government closest to citizens, a very direct impact on daily lives, we took a look at what could be done to reduce gender-based inequalities and also looked for inspiration across European cities. We produced a report, which is available at urbact.eu, and talked about some of the ways in which cities can address these challenges. So in terms of stats, it's quite interesting to look. Even before the pandemic, some of the challenges we still face related to gender equality in terms of representation, 17% of mayors or council leaders in the EU are women. The pay gap, women are paid on average 16% less than men in the European Union. And I think you're probably familiar with this in The Urbanist, that cities have historically been designed by men, architecture, engineering, planning are dominated by men, and that there's a connection between the physical structure of a city and the quality of everyday life. And that can look quite different if you're a woman or a man.
Okay, so lots to unpack there. So first of all, on the issue of how women gain better access to resources and things as we build back, give me some examples of how the pandemic has particularly hit women over the past year. Is that in access to employment? Is that in the added burden of childcare and home education? What are some of the things that you saw as the pressure points?
We have been looking at the gendered impacts of the pandemic, so we see it as a risk that's potentially derailing some of the progress on gender equality. And I think you're right that the particular elements of impact are around the care burden, around domestic violence, and around the economy. So outside the world of work, you're quite right, the burden of additional caring responsibilities seems to have been disproportionately placed on women. And that can mean the women who are working, it can lower their productivity and it can reduce, therefore, career progression and pay. We've all been forced to retreat into the private sphere at home during lockdowns. And that has potentially undermined, I think, women's ability to take part in civic and political life going forward. And then linked to that, there've been additional personal risks for some women who have been distanced from their support networks. And we've seen, unfortunately, a spike in domestic violence. That's probably global, with a high demand on support services like shelters and counselling. And they're often delivered at local level in cities. And I think that highlights that we need a wider and longer term strategy to combat gender-based violence going forward. And then finally, you're right, it's about the economy and job losses. I mean, there's a lot of evidence right now that job losses are hitting traditionally female sectors harder, like retail and service industries. We have seen that part-time and flexible work, which is more often held by women, is more precarious. And on the other hand, male-dominated sectors like construction and tech have been less impacted so far and are likely to benefit from some of the stimulus funds that are going forward for recovery. I'll give you an example. The European Institute for Gender Equality have reported that during the first wave of the pandemic, employment for women reduced by 2.2 million across the EU. And then when jobs started to pick up again last summer, women gained only half as many jobs as men. And we've seen this before with economic crises, that these impacts have longer lasting effects potentially for women.
So we have all these systemic issues with, you know, the way that cities are run. I know you've been looking at a plan of action, because I guess too often we end up in a situation of knowing what's wrong with the city or identifying how certain groups don't have access to the same chances as others. But you've come out very positively and said, OK, this is the problem. Now this is what we can do about it. What's on that kind of checklist that you've come up with for cities to act on?
We do have some ideas about how to challenge this, partly because of the work we've done in the past, not just Urbac, but lots of other organisations. And if we want to build back better, this phrase that's framing the recovery, I think for us that means building back more equitably. And that starts with an acknowledgement of these gendered impacts and understanding the gendered impacts, as well as those sort of pre-existing inequalities that I just talked about. And we do know quite a lot of the policy responses that work. So they're around several headings, I'd say. The first one of which is about representation. So having women in leadership roles, that means we have full representation and different voices creating policy, but also creating change and influencing social norms about who leads. We know that in cities, local democracy is about both formal and informal representation and participative processes. So we would recommend to our city makers and city changers, be conscious about who's around the table making policy and think who's empowered to contribute to decision making, which voices are not being heard, and how can you fill those kind of knowledge and representation gaps? So representation is kind of one of the big constants, I think, in how cities drive change. A second one is around data, transparency and good data. So we need sex disaggregated data collection, partly on the disease itself. And we see that. I think there's quite a lot of data about how COVID, the disease itself, is affecting men and women differently, but also on the economic impacts, like on the care burden, on violence, but also on the recovery. And that data we need at all levels of governance, like from city level up to international level.
And Sally, obviously the economy is vital here at giving women access back into the world of work and back into leading independent lives. Tell us some of the things that you're looking at here.
In terms of the economy and the recovery, we can see a push for percentage targets for women, business and workers in bailout and recovery funds. And for example, the EU Recovery and Resilience Facility, as it's called, that's going to be 672 billion of loans and grants. And it'll be really interesting to see how much of that is going to be spent to maintain women's jobs and stimulus for parts of the economy where women can be trained and welcomed. At local level, cities and their economic agencies can make these sort of targeted initiatives. And we've seen these in places like Barcelona and Frankfurt doing a really good job, where they have training, access to finance, gender-sensitive procurement policies to empower women to contribute to the recovery, because there are a lot of studies that show gender equality increases GDP and job creation. And cities can also use their leverage through things like local supply chains to guarantee that women workers have access to decent work and equal opportunities. And I guess in the end, the aim is to make sure that the labour market is sort of fairer and safer and allows both men and women to enjoy fulfilling lives with space for professional and personal development.
What was interesting after the terrible killing of Sarah Everard was, you know, that a debate started about urbanism and making cities more equitable that was even picked up here in the UK by, surprisingly, by lead figures in the Tory administration, who were saying, OK, let's look at how urbanism works in favour of women and how we can make it support women more going forwards. And one of those things, for example, was, you know, around the debate about improving street lighting and things. Is that the kind of thing that you think is important? Because again, it's a bit complicated, because on one hand, yes, it would be great if everywhere was lit like a runway. But on the other hand, the bigger issue seems to be getting men to change their behaviour rather than just making everywhere floodlit. So I just wondered, when you heard that debate, what you felt about it?
I think it's good that we're having that debate for a start. And in fact, in our report, the Gender Equal Cities report, we have a couple of sections on planning and public space, looking at good examples across Europe of how to plan for cities, how to make them more equitable. And a lot of this is about inclusive design, which is better for everybody, not just for women and girls. I think it's much more complex than just lighting, I have to say. It is partly about, of course, going back to behaviour, having awareness campaigns, talking to men and boys about their behaviour, about what it means to be a man, how to treat women and girls, but also having more female urban planners. We did a study visit in Vienna, which you probably, I'm sure it's a city you know quite well, who've done some fantastic work on redesigning public spaces and parks with a gender lens. And some of those changes are quite subtle, but really make a difference to how women and girls feel in public space, how safe and welcome they feel, and getting those kind of design principles right at grassroots level.
You mentioned Vienna there. Just as our listeners go off and think about other cities to look at the practices and the policies they have in place, where would you like to have a look at?
I mean, to be honest, I think every city can do this. In our report, we had good examples from across Europe in cities, for instance, Poznan in Poland, who are renaming their streets, thinking about a campaign to give street names, more women's street names. In Barcelona, of course, there's some fantastic stuff going on in terms of public space, things like seating, places where people want to linger. Public toilets is always a big thing. It's a feminist issue, having more public toilets. And there's evidence, for instance, older women are encouraged to go out and maintain their independence if there's somewhere where they can sit on the way to the shop. So these are sort of, I wouldn't like to say that there's one city to go and look at. I think every city can do this. And there are lots of small steps taking place all over in small, medium and large cities across Europe.
And that's the great thing. We always talk about that here in the urbanists. It's often these small interventions that are most effective and speedy to be delivered as well. Sally, great to speak to you. And thank you so much for coming on The Urbanist. Next up, the equality of spaces and access. Mariella Alfonso is the founder and CEO of State of Place, which produces an AI-driven urban design data and predictive analytics software. Well, she helps city makers make decisions to create livable, equitable and sustainable places. She's also co-authored an article with Sam Lubell about spatial equality and ensuring access to facilities for all. And she joins me on the show now. Mariella, welcome to The Urbanist. Let's just start by explaining to our listeners a little bit about what you do exactly and what is State of Place.
To help you better understand State of Place, I think it's helpful to understand kind of my background. I have a PhD in urban planning, focused on the relationship between urban design and behavior. So my work has focused on quantifying how the built environment shapes us, how it shapes our thinking, behaviors, perceptions, and then how that translates back into quality of life outcomes and value, like social value, environmental value, health value, and even economic development value. And so basically, I've spent my entire career using this data and evidence to advocate for better urban design. And State of Place is a manifestation of that, a way to sort of tap into data and evidence that typically would be behind an academic firewall that you have to pay like $35 an article for, and actually use that data in a way that translates to actions and recommendations. So what specifically State of Place is, you know, it's we collect data on the built environment. So these are like what we call micro-scale urban design features. It's the nuts and bolts of places, what you feel when you go down a street. We measure everything from a design perspective that would influence that. So like sidewalks, trees, benches, parks, public plazas, those kinds of things, lighting. And then we quantify that into an index called the State of Place Index, which basically measures quality of place, and then have tied that back to a variety of quality of life outcomes. And what this data and evidence allows us to do is help city makers use this same data and evidence to make more effective and cost-efficient decisions about, you know, where to invest, how to identify vulnerable communities that need that investment the most. Working with communities, we have like a kind of a fun SimCity-like scenario tool that can be used alongside with communities so that they can create visions of the kinds of neighborhoods that they would want their neighborhood to be, what kinds of changes that implies, and then actually forecast and quantify, okay, if we make these changes, what could be the impact to something like a reduction in diabetes or reduction in poor air quality, you know, so that the stakeholders involved in city making, both the public and private sector communities, can use that data to advocate, say, this is why this investment is worthwhile. These are the benefits that you're going to see, as well as kind of identify the changes that are going to have the biggest impact from a quality of life perspective, especially for vulnerable communities. I think with state of place, what that allows you to specifically see is how the patterns of vulnerable communities tie back from a spatial perspective. Because of course, there's been decades long of disinvestment in community level infrastructure that is one of the key reasons why we see these vulnerabilities in these communities. There's nothing inherent to them that makes them vulnerable. It's very much tied to the spatial environments in which they live and the policies and often structurally racist policies that have disinvested in those places.
And tell me, during the pandemic, has that issue become even harsher?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the same long-suffering vulnerable communities of the pre-COVID world. Those are the same ones that have been disproportionately borne the burden of the pandemic, essentially across all aspects of their lives. You have Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities. You know, we've all seen the statistics. They have anywhere between, you know, 2 to 3 times more hospitalizations and deaths because of COVID, as opposed to their white counterparts. Those on Medicaid, so low-income communities, also have a higher burden of disease. Same with those that are imprisoned, although that has a different kind of spatial justice lens to it, of course. You know, and then, of course, the older adults. But the thing to also consider is that the inequitable impacts of the pandemic extend beyond the health ones, right? So you have small businesses that are owned by people of color are nearly 30% more likely to be forced to actually close their businesses than those owned by whites. It's also been harder for them to navigate the PPP process. Black, Latino, and Asian communities are also 2 to 3 times more likely to be behind on rent and then, you know, face higher threats of eviction and homelessness, etc. And so what we've been trying to kind of highlight is the spatial equity reasons for these specific disproportionate outcomes that COVID really has just laid bare. They were already there. It's just made it worse and it's magnified this. And a lot of this is tied to the built environment. A lot of the pre-existing conditions, the comorbidities that are tied to COVID, those were tied to disinvestments in the built environment. So you have built environments that don't support healthy behaviors, for example, or healthy living. So you may have higher rates of asthma because of poor pollution, because of environmental policies that were unjust and racist. And that's one of the things that COVID has been preying upon.
As an example of that, it was interesting reading an article you recently wrote about this topic, where you were highlighting the access to, for example, parks and recreational spaces for different communities, and highlighting the fact that many poorer or Black communities or Brown communities were less likely to have good access to those things. Now, I guess on first glance, for many listeners, they may think, well, those are the softer aspects of urbanism, and does it really matter whether you have to walk an extra few blocks to get to a piece of green space or to a place to play basketball, for example? But actually, as you were hinting, that has bigger ramifications, doesn't it, on your health outcomes, on the opportunities for release from the stresses of your day, so on your mental health as well.
Absolutely. And you've basically described the issue of spatial equity that myself and my co-author, Sam Lubell, who also wrote the piece in Slate, were trying to highlight. So, you know, these same communities that have suffered from decades long disinvestment in community level infrastructure, like what you mentioned, parks, public spaces, street trees and sidewalks, these are the same that have been suffering most in the post-COVID world. So one of the things that we've been doing to sort of quantify that these things kind of mattered way before COVID, and yes, access to parks and public spaces mattered before, it matters now, it's going to matter after COVID, is with State of Place, we've been working with the City of Philadelphia basically quantifying the quality of the built environment across about a third of the city. And we're not just looking at tying that back to COVID outcomes and all the comorbidities or chronic diseases tied to COVID, but also rates of floods, incidences of heat waves, crime, and other quality of life factors. And what we have found so far is that poor quality urban design is statistically tied to higher rates of COVID, and also most notably to all related comorbidities like we thought. So this means that pre-existing disinvestments in the built environments of vulnerable communities, which are tied to those structurally racist urban policies and plans I mentioned before, were already tied to higher rates of chronic disease, and COVID, again, merely preyed upon that. So what we found is that the urban design, again, it really does matter. Recreational facilities, like you mentioned, sidewalks, curb cuts, all these nitty-gritty aspects of place that kind of impact your life, you know, they end up mattering not just to COVID, but to crime, to environmental quality, and other issues of access. And again, sadly, neighborhoods with poor quality built environments and higher rates of COVID were also lower income. They had lower rates of education, higher percentages of Black residents, higher household sizes, less access to vehicles, fewer people working from home. And this was true not just for rates of COVID hospitalizations and fatalities, and this gets to your point, but also of transmission. So that means that the lack of access to quality built environments in which to socially distance, for example, also contributed to more vulnerable communities getting COVID. So it really did matter whether you had access to that park or playground. And especially in the early days of the pandemic, if you think about people were avoiding public transport, but if you didn't have a car and you were afraid to get on public transport, where were you going to go and socially distance in a way that was healthy, both from a physical perspective to avoid transmission, but also, as you mentioned, from a mental health perspective?
And Mario, just tell me, on the bigger political landscape, you know, we have a new administration in DC, which is more minded to do things around equity and is certainly concerned about controlling the pandemic in a way that we haven't seen in the last few years. You have a series of civic leaders who are powerful, often come from more diverse communities. Is this a moment of change for cities and the way that they're built and planned, and will they build back better?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I have hope that we've absolutely made huge strides because of the new administration and the various appointees that they've put at the head of, you know, DOT and HUD and EPA and CDC and others. And it's very clear that the idea of racial equity has been embedded into all manner of issues and policies, from criminal justice to environmental justice, health equity, and even infrastructure. And I think that that's a really important, significant first step. But I do think that we need to take just a slightly more of a step towards the direction of spatial justice, being able to recognize that many of these things are tied back to the built environment. When you consider, you know, since the Reconstruction days that prompted Jim Crow, segregation, racial covenants, redlining, mortgage discrimination, urban renewal policies, you know, highway expansions that tore through the heart of once vibrant Black communities, to even gentrification and displacement issues today, it's place that underlies all of these racist policies and programs. And so this inequitable quality of life outcomes manifest themselves not just in people, but in places.
My thanks to Mariela Alfonso there, the founder and CEO of State of Place. Finally today, we look at the world of land use and zoning to offer some ideas for economic equality born out of policy reform. To learn more, I'm now joined by Emily Hamilton, a senior research fellow and the director of the Urbanity Project at the MacArthur Center at George Mason University. Emily, thank you for joining us. One of the things you've been looking at is how zoning can contribute to achieving better equality in our cities. Tell us how something so seemingly innocuous can actually have such an important impact.
Zoning is the primary tool for regulating land use in U.S. cities, and it's intended to generally separate different types of land uses from each other. So the kind of typical example that a zoning supporter might give is that it's used to separate polluting industrial uses from residential areas, or bars from schools, or something like that. But zoning also has the effect, as it's implemented in the U.S., of really restricting residential density through single-family zoning and minimum lot size requirements. And it, as a result, can make housing very expensive in places where land is expensive because of these requirements that each unit of housing has to have a certain amount of land. And as a result, low or middle income residents can be shut out of neighborhoods or even entire localities.
And tell me, one of the other things that we've seen during the past year is changing work patterns. So more people spending more time working at home, people moving to suburbs where they feel that there's a little bit more greenery, a little bit of a better community for them to be involved in, but also a desire to commute a little bit less. So other people wondering whether they should live closer to their place of work. Now, in traditional zoning, as you said, you would separate many of these functions out of retail and residential and the corporate HQs, for example. I know that one of the things you've hinted at is a shake-up around this as well. Do you think it would be beneficial that within areas of light manufacturing, which aren't heavy polluters, that you add in more residential, again, so that it reflects the kind of changing work patterns we have?
Yes, the pandemic has accelerated some trends that were already in place prior to COVID. So remote work was on the rise in the US, and I imagine in Europe as well. And online shopping has meant that there's less of a demand for certain types of retail space. So as a result of commercial use zoning restrictions, in some cases, buildings are sitting vacant because landlords just can't find any tenants who can maintain a business in a certain retail space or in a perhaps somewhat outdated office building. So allowing these buildings to either be redeveloped or repurposed as residential use in places where housing is very expensive, but the commercial vacancy rate might be somewhat high and rising, makes a lot of sense, both for avoiding vacancy and for allowing more housing in locations that are often very desirable and walkable parts of localities.
And many people have, you know, been horribly challenged over the past year. They may be thinking about starting up their own ventures, moving into the world of entrepreneurship themselves, or perhaps they're already in that space, but they now see some opportunities with more affordable rents around the nature of commercial properties and things. Is this somewhere where you'd like to see more flexibility for startups or pop-up businesses, for the chance for people to have a try at something to see whether it brings back interest to main streets, high streets around the US?
Yes, certainly. Commercial use zoning in the US is often extremely prescriptive, to the point that it's laughable when you look at the specific types of uses that might be permitted on a specific piece of land, limiting, for example, the amount of revenue that a restaurant can make from alcohol sales versus food sales in a certain zone. So in this time of a lot of business closures and upheaval in a lot of the retail sector, it makes a lot of sense to relax these use restrictions to allow for all kinds of creative new uses, whether that's a pop-up business or simply a business that doesn't quite meet the current zoning limitations of the space where it wants to operate. And parking restrictions in the U.S. often play a big role in that also, because different types of uses have often their own specific parking requirements. So if one use is no longer viable in a specific building, that building might sit empty until a use that requires the same or less amount of parking comes along.
And tell me, do you feel that this is going to happen? Because it feels like lots of people we get on the show and when we speak to people in cities around the world, they'll say, actually, who would believe it? But my city council, my city hall has traditionally been quite conservative with a small C, you know, reluctant to push through change, a bit slow moving. But actually, at this moment, it seemed to be embracing a bit more of an adventurous spirit and recognizing that stuff has to happen and happen fast. Is that something you're seeing in the US? Because these are all great ideas, but do you think they're going to be implemented?
Yes, we have seen some experimentation in the US with, for example, localities allowing restaurants to create street-facing takeout windows or to operate small grocery stores or catering companies out of spaces that would typically be very limited to restaurants exclusively, which is great to see. And we've also seen some experimentation with closing off certain streets to cars to make more outdoor space available for walking or dining or people just hanging out in the relatively safe outdoor spaces as a way to socialize during the pandemic. And some of these experiments, I think, have proven successful enough that they may be adopted permanently.
Emily Hamilton, director of the Urbanity Project at the MacArthur Center at George Mason University. Thank you for joining me. Well, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, well, here's Sigrid with Level Up. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
Nothing you say's gonna push me away, so don't brush it under the rug, 'cause when we get through this trouble